Hello, I'm Sophie Grove and welcome to The Big Interview here on Monocle 24. My guest today is a towering figure in the story of art, the grand dame of the avant-garde, a woman who for many years has devised artworks that have shocked, inspired, horrified, but always transfixed the public. Marina Abramović was born in Belgrade in 1946 to two venerated war heroes, both Communist Party officials in Tito's regime. Abramović began as a painter but quickly found her calling as an agitator and performance artist. From early on, her work involved extreme deprivation, self-mutilation and feats of incredible physical endurance. In 1975, Abramović etched a pentagram to her stomach with a smashed wine glass and lashed the wound with a whip until blood flew around the room. In the same year, she brushed her hair so many times, her scalp bled. Later in 1997, at the Venice Biennale, she won the Golden Lion for scrubbing a pile of bloody cow bones for four long days as images of her parents flashed up on screens around her. In a recent 2010 work, she sat in a chair at the Museum of Modern Art in New York for 700 hours as members of the public took the seat in front of her for the ultimate artistic face-off. While her work deals in pain, risk and fear, Abramović has always nurtured humour, spirituality and sexuality. She herself says her work is about simplicity, humility and collectivity. Like all great art, it addresses the human condition. And I'm pleased to say that Marina Abramović joins me at the Moderna Museet in Stockholm today. Marina, it's wonderful to be here in Stockholm with you today. We've just been walking around the show looking at really what struck me was the incredible physical feats that you've completed in your work for so many years. And I wanted to take you back to the very beginning and to your childhood. By all accounts, your mother was a very strong woman. Your upbringing was incredibly strict, brutal almost. And I wondered how much you can credit her with essentially instilling you with this ethic, this physical ethic that you have, and this endurance that you have.
But of course, you know, when I grew up in former Yugoslavia, I hated it, and I hated the structure, and I hated the dictatorship, you know, that she kind of posed to my life. And, you know, if, let's say, if I would get good notes in the school, or me or my brother, she would call the professor and say, how you can give her such a good notes? She didn't study enough. And then he would ask me more questions and I would get bad notes. And then she would say, you see, you didn't study enough. So this kind of, I always have to prove herself to her, and I was never good enough. So it was this incredible, strong control, you know, over everything and discipline. And of course, when I was there, and as a young child, I hated, you know, and I would always do opposite. If she say white, I would say black. If she tell me to do this, I would try. I was a rebellion constantly. But then in a way, you know, looking backwards, and looking now into my old career, I see how important was this kind of discipline. And especially when my mother died, I discovered her diaries. And I never really made a peace with her. But I discovered diaries when I was cleaning her, you know, her apartment. And it shocked me because in these diaries, she was incredibly sensitive, emotional, and wounded woman, you know, and with, you know, have this immense love for my father who left her when she was like in her 40s and she never actually remarried and have any other man. So if I knew these diaries, if I knew just one page of these diaries, my relation to her would be different. But what she done to me, she actually want me to make me strong. He want me to make me soldier. She want to make me warrior. And she actually succeed because this kind of work I've been doing without discipline and crazy willpower, you could not do it. You can be incredibly physically fit, but if you don't have dedication and the kind of, you know, obsession of this work, I will never succeed. So in a way, you know, this now I'm 70. Looking back, it was a good thing.
I mean, I've been reading your amazing autobiography and in it you say, I come from a dark place. Your childhood sounds fairly miserable. And I wondered, even though your parents were you know, war heroes and these officials in the communist regime. You, little Marina, was, you know, really treated badly. Do you think that unhappy childhoods make brilliant artists?
You know, I was always joking in, with my students. You know, I teach more than 25 years, and I always say to them, you know, the bad childhood, good artist. Good childhood, you know, it's not so clear how good you can get because you don't have enough material to work with. But, you know, it's not necessary to be that unhappy. But, you know, I can't talk for the rest of the world, but I can talk for myself. I was feeling very lonely and extremely emotional and kind of sad, you know. But I also think sadness also comes from the idea of being Slavic. Because if you think Russians and all the literature and movies and films and music, they're so melancholic. The Slavic soul is generally melancholic. We are melancholic about the universe. We are melancholic about that we're going to die one day. I remember I was 16 or something, and I realized, oh, my God, I'm going to die. And I was so sad about it, that every single day could be the last. And I still have the same melancholy, you know. And the childhoods just contribute all this. And also being in a privileged family like I was, everybody was thinking how great is being, you know, in that kind of family because everything was done for me, you know. We have maids and I have a teacher for French and teacher for English and piano teacher. And everything was easy. But in that easy, you know, kind of circumstances, I was so lonely because everything was forbidden and everything was restricted. And you know, I will never be enough. She will never give me money to buy something that is beautiful or clothes that I like to wear. Every birthday, I will get pajama who is five numbers too big. And she always said when they wash, they will shrink, but they never did. And I will always looking ugly to myself. But there will be always money for the paint, always money for the to see the classic music, ballet, or, you know, or the theater piece, and any book I want. But at the same time, you know, I never heard about Rolling Stones or Beatles till I was 30 years old because this music was forbidden. I was just listening classic music. Then I came to Amsterdam. Do you believe from that kind of restrictions come to Amsterdam? But everything was free and possible. And then I didn't know what to do with my old self because my work was based about breaking restrictions and breaking these borders. I come to the place that restrictions didn't matter. That who cares if you're naked or not naked, whatever you want to do in your life. So I was like lost. Then I have to build all new kind of set of new restrictions for myself that I can break them again.
Your work is so synonymous with performance art that people have somehow forgotten that it started with the paint. Yeah. And I wondered, is there and was there a moment that you changed and you realized this is not my medium? Can you put your finger on that sort of process?
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's very important that, you know, the beginning of the show, the first room, and lots of this thinking process is there. And this we never show anywhere. And I was so fascinated. The curators want so much to show my beginning. They want to show my diaries from age 14, my paintings from 14. I was like really early. I think all my life I was an artist. I could not do anything else. And so that room is like now going back to past. You know, I never actually go back to past. I always look into future or what is happening now. So this is really difficult show for me because I have to look into this young little Marina who had all these dreams and, you know, expectations and want to be an artist and nothing else. But, you know, I paint, and my first paintings was paintings of my dreams because it was given to me. It was easy. You know, I have the dream and I wake up in the morning, I paint it. And then I have all these crashes with the cars and trucks, and my paintings of car crashes was interesting. So this beginning of the catalog, this perspective, the curator wrote how this car crashes was actually so similar to my performances with Ulay, because our first piece we ever made together, it was running two naked bodies and crashing together. And I was never even connect this with my paintings that actually, if you look back, is a straight line. You know, everything had a reason how to develop from one thing to another. But that moment that I really stopped painting, it was very clear in my mind because I was painting clouds. And I have all these different types of clouds, clouds who are coming, the clouds who are shadows, the projections of the clouds, the black holes and so on. Your universe was interesting for me. And then I remember this very well, lying on the field and looking at the sky. And it was absolutely blue sky, no clouds, because I always look at the clouds to study them, but there was no cloud. And they come these military planes to cross the horizon, and they create these lines in the sky, and they make like an abstract drawing, and then the plane left, and the drawing was still there, and then disappear and become blue sky. This was fascinating me. This was like almost like a spiritual revelation. I stand up from there, and I knew I would never paint again, because I understood that artists can make things from anything, from dust if he wants, that I can make use my body, I can use fire, I can use water, I can use the aeroplanes to make these drawings in the sky if I want to. There was limitless forms. And then when I made my first performance in the front of public, it was called Rhythm 10, I knew that that moment that I will never go back to the studio, because it's all about media. That as a young artist that you can find what is the best for you. The electricity and the energy went through me between audience and me, and the kind of almost symbiotic moment what happened in that space was so much stronger than me painting alone in the studio. I could never go back, ever. And this is 55 years later. I'm still performing.
And tell me, you were at the Belgrade Academy of Fine Arts and then you were doing these incredible performances. But what was the art scene like? And this is Tito's Yugoslavia. I mean, you mentioned, you know, you had this incredible moment when you left and went to Amsterdam. But before that, what was it like working in that environment?
You know, as I said, I come from the part that was privileged. And in, I remember in 1968, we have the student demonstrations, and there's lots of chapter in this book talking how disappointed I was in communism and so on. But at the same time, in these demonstrations, we asked Tito for a student cultural center, and he gave to us. And this student cultural center became like a center of actually of new ideas. It was six of us. I was the only woman and five guys. And we actually, this student cultural center became our new home. We will come there and start thinking about how to express our work, the new ideas, and to think differently. So the first show we had there, it was very important to me because it was not any more painting-related work. It was called Drangularium, which in translation means little things. So the curator asked us to bring the things that inspire us, but not the work itself. So there was such an interesting show that one person bring the door of his studio, because he say that when he opened the door of the studio, that really is the moment that he entered to another space. And it's very inspirational, like a different type of reality. So the door he showed there. The another one take the old radio that he said that he always listens to radio when he's making his work. So the radio was there. Then one bring his girlfriend, and he said, you know, I always make love to my girlfriend before I go to studio. So she sit on the chair. So she was there, and so on and so on. And I remember I bring a little peanut, which I pin with a, you know, pin on the wall. And I call this the cloud and his shadow, because actually it's cloud in the shadow. And this was like, you know, thinking out of object, because the peanut really remind me on the cloud. And this was the beginning of a new idea of thinking. And then, you know, performance, how to use sound, music, body, and so on. This was very important. And we was isolated in that student culture center completely, because the director of the student culture center, that she was a daughter of the Minister of Culture of Croatia. So it was like protected area. But at the same time, we didn't have any kind of public. The only public was my boyfriends and the girlfriends of the guys who show. So we had 10 people, 15 or 30. So it was like a kind of vacuum in the area. And we spent working for 5 years. And then I felt I'm not going anywhere. You know, we didn't matter what we are doing there, because we was isolated in this kind of, you know, privileged situation. And then I left. And all the guys stayed there, and still they're there. They never left. It's, you have to have courage to go. It's very important to leave and to see what you can find yourself.
And I want to ask you about this idea of the audience and risk. Your faith in the audience is enormous. And I mean,
but also the audience faith in me.
Exactly, yes. Yes. I mean, you have an amazing, loyal audience often, and there is an alchemy in the room when you perform. But I've seen, everyone has seen the footage of you when you hand, you know, essentially tools to the audience all those years ago and said, I'm an object, do what you will with me. And, you know, people in a 1974 performance were, you know, actually given permission really to maim you. I mean, that relationship is very complex, but You know, how did you decide to take that enormous risk, the risk of your own life in that instance?
But, you know, first of all, it's very much to do with the character of performance art. Performance is time-based art. Performance, it's living form of art. And if you perform without audience, nothing happens. Audience and the performer complete the work. So it's all kind of biology and chemistry between the two, you know. And in this particular piece we're talking about, Rhythm Zero, it was very important. It was done in the time when performance art was just in the beginning, where we've been so much criticized and so much, you know, kind of torture with the labels like we are masochist or we are sadist or this is not art, this is bullshit and so on and so on. So I really wanted to figure out if I actually give a complete right to audience to do whatever they want with me, including killing me with this one bullet and pistol, you know, to see how far audience can go. If I don't do anything, if I'm not masochist, I'm not a sadist, I'm just standing in the space and I have a table of 70, you know, two objects and you can do whatever with me. This was a huge risk to do. And I was very young, by the way. And then I just did it. And I know, you know, my experience of this performance that audience can really kill you. So the thing is that what I learned, that if you give the really dangerous tools to the audience they're going to use, if to give them the different tools they can use it. You can bring the audience spirit down or you can lift the audience spirit. So it's really important, the performance that I made much later, like Artist is Present, which I give the tools, basically nothing, just look at you in your eyes. And then the audience completely behave differently. I really experience and kind of explore every possible relation to the audience in 55 years of my career now.
But that particular performance in 74 could have gone horribly wrong. I mean, yes, but someone had a gun to your neck.
Yeah, but also, that's true, but this is the risk you have to take. I did this risk, you know, and again, I come from the family of heroes, yeah. Which probably means something, I don't know. But I had the courage that I don't know. I just, you know, I think when we are in the state of performing, that you're kind of, there is an angel who will keep you alive. I don't know. I believe in this. You remember with the people, they say when people are drunk and they fall down, they never really hurt themselves mostly because somehow that state keep them, you know, safe. I don't know. In many times I can go wrong things, but they didn't, you know.
The very notion of pain is interesting. I mean, for instance, just speaking to you now, I wouldn't imagine that you were the type of person that would be capable of just drawing a pentagram and, you know, on your stomach and, you know, etching
but,
it
yeah,
in,
but the
in
body,
blood.
But you have to see, you know, from the point of view of the performance artist, the body. Bodies are just a tool. You know, I went to the most difficult operations of human body when I was in my 20s. A brain, a hip replacement, a spine, a heart, whatever, 3, 4, 5, 6 hours. You know, when you open the body, use the same tools like in the kitchen. There is a nails, there is a wires, there is a whatever, hammer, a saw, and stuff like that. You put together. It's really what always interests me is the soul and spirit in the body, what really moves everything. And we are just the shell. And that we always afraid of the same things, afraid of pain, of suffering, and mortality. And these three things which people are afraid of is reflected to the human history and art since the beginning. You know, every painting, every great piece of literature, the film, deals with this. And I deal with the same thing, except I stage these things in front of audience. And dangerous moments. I go through dangerous moments, but I will never go in my own life because I don't have this energy. I use energy of the public to help me to pass that kind of limits. And I show to them, like I'm their mirror, if I can do this and free myself from the fear of pain, of mortality and suffering, they can do the same. So I just use myself as a tool in order to communicate these ideas to audience.
But do you have a high pain threshold, potentially?
I do, actually. Because, you know, I come from the family with my mother, when she take two out, she never want to use injection, ever. When she was giving birth to me, she had a communist meeting where she was a president, and the water broke down, and she didn't want to stop till she finished the conference. I mean, so it's like, and my father, who had so many bullets everywhere, and he take with a knife the bullet and put tobacco, and that's it. I mean, this kind of guys. So.
Now, I wanted to move on to talk about, well, one of your most famous works we've seen upstairs, is a performance where you brush your hair so many times. And you're saying art must be beautiful, and you're brushing your hair, and eventually your scalp is raw and it bleeds. And it strikes me as a protest work, especially for its time.
Very much so.
About
very sarcastic,
art and beauty.
Yeah. You know, at that time when this piece was made in 1975, the people who buy the paintings to match the carpets or the sofa, you know, because the whole idea of the colors and beauty and how art have to be beautiful, to me was at that time totally wrong, because I felt that art have to be disturbing, art have to predict future, art have to, you know, create new consciousness, art have to move people in so many ways. And this was came out of that. So I'm doing something that actually, you know, looks like, okay, you're combing the hair, but you're going so violently that actually you produce different effect by always repeating this text, art must be beautiful and artists must be beautiful. And you know, now I was one of the first to introduce this idea of reperformance. And it's incredibly interesting that this piece being reperformed also will be reperformed here, but with different cultures. And but recently we also have the men reperforming this piece, women reperforming this piece. And lately we had in China, in Shanghai, something like 25 Chinese performance artists reperform. It was incredible with the China what happened. That the women, I don't know, they never could express any emotions. The women literally was screaming, crying, bleeding. They went so much farther than I did in my own performance. I was very shocked about the reaction. So this performance become the tool expressing all which is restricted and all which is kind of pressed down in the different, you know, cultures and social life.
We were just talking off mic about your show in 2020 and the Royal Academy. You'll be the first woman to have a solo show there.
That's your culture. I have no idea why I should be the first woman there.
Exactly. I mean, how much has changed? Even though that work was, you know, absolutely biting at its time, it still bites. Tell me a bit about that. I mean, you've worked as a woman in art for so many decades. How much have you seen really genuinely change and perceptions of women in art?
You know, it's such amazing. This is a great question, because the change is so minimal or none. If I go back into the 70s and I look at the bad critics and I look how I was crucifying, how my work was so much criticized and how I was always like a black sheep of everything, you know? And then looking now, I mean, right now, I'm actually almost criticized as much as I was in the 70s. I've been labeled as a satanism, that I will use spirit cooking. Then, you know, I came with my biography, which I said that I had 3 abortions because I didn't want to have children, because I want to do art. But the women attack me unbelievable. How I dare to do this? How I dare to decide for myself? And one thing that is most interesting right now, before in early 70s, I was very much criticized by men. Right now, I'm more criticized by women than ever before. But I want to say, you know, it's like now, it's like it's almost not allowed to be successful, to really accept your age, tell all the truths about my life and everything else, and do what I'm doing. It's like, I am so much criticized by the women, especially my own age. And then we have the all young generation of women who I become kind of hero. So all these contradictions are never changed. It's always follow me, whatever I do. And I can't, you know, make sense out of this. Why is like that?
You know, we do seem to be moving into a big cycle of political change. There have been many waves of feminism in your career, and there seems to be a new one sort of on the horizon, or already have
and
begun.
I was always against feminism from the beginning, and still.
Well, I suppose you've seen so many different sort of episodes in this kind of like story of women, potentially in art, potentially in sort of performance art. Do you think that women artists will be crucial to this new political era? Do they have still a very big sort of message to put across, and do you think they're doing
but this,
doing
you know,
it?
Which, I'm always saying the same thing. I hate the division between man and woman and art. I always believe it doesn't matter who is doing art. It's only 2 categories, good art, bad art. That's it. And who cares? It's transgender, American, African, lesbian, gay, any kind of social group, religious belonging. Doesn't matter all this. And the moment when you say, you know, feminism, feminine art, you create kind of ghetto, which I hate, because you take yourself into the kind of different category. And I think the art have to be for everybody. And the same, I always say, yes, I'm female, but I'm not female artist. I am the artist, no gender. attached. And that's for me very important. And it's all the feminism comes in so many different forms. But my always question is that in a way, if the women really take the power they already have, we have the power we don't need to fight for because we just don't believe in it. But just the idea that you can create life in your body is unbelievable power. And I don't know, I was in the situations in ex-Yugoslavia, which was the only one who actually never completely, you know, reject this kind of division and just done my thing. I came to Italy to make my career, very big career in Italy, which was no woman artist around me because they sit home and they serve men and they play this fragile, shitty role to please the big housewives. It's all how you deal with things. But, you know, this is why I don't have any successful marriage or children or normal life, you know, and there's lots of loneliness, all that. But I chose that. The thing is that why do men have more to do than women in a successful career is that men are ready to sacrifice more than women. Women that don't ready to sacrifice because to motherhood, to be loved, to have the wife, to have the children, to have all this happy family. And they want to be an artist. And you know, guess what? You can't. You have one energy in the body and it's in no way that you can do all this. And man, yes, he made the children, but he do his career because woman is there to follow this whole thing and create, you know, the structure that everything is fine. But what if we don't create this kind of structure? I never did. Everything I want to do in my life, I did. I don't regret anything, but I never made compromise. But also doesn't mean that my life is happy all the time. Lots of broken heart and nobody want to be with me because I'm too much for everybody. You know, it's like very hard, you know, because I just go forwards of the thing I believe. But satisfaction to create the work who really matters to the public and satisfaction that I can communicate the message is much bigger than having any of this private happiness, you know. It's just different, different choice you have to make. And I think if the woman made that kind of choice, it would be no difference at all. That's no difference.
Can I ask you about legacy and how you want to be remembered? I mean, it strikes me that you still feel like you are a sort of an alternative artist when actually really your place is in, you know, right there in the canon. How will you be remembered and what are your sort of next few years going to be all about?
I think the people remember by the number of people they've been loved for. You know, like I think I will be remembered through the public who actually have direct, you know, contact with me, performance and what I give to them. You know, I think that one thing that I always do is to work with very young generation of artists and be very generous to them. And they are wonderful to me because I give them my experience unconditionally, but they give me sense of time and live. So they always keep me in this presence, you know, now. And my generation bores me to death. And you know, if only my generation comes to the opening, I know they're jealous to see if I'm still alive, but that's it. But I have 80%, 90%, any lecture, anything I do publicly, extremely young people. So that's the way that my art's going to live through. Only that generation.
Marina, it's been wonderful, wonderful to speak to you today. Thank you very much for joining me on Monocle 24.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Big Interview with me, Sophie Grove, in conversation with Marina Abramović. The Big Interview is produced by Gerd Luth. Until next time, thank you very much for listening and goodbye.